This interview was recorded for the Dersingham 2000 History Project on the 12th of November 1998. Please may I have your full name?
Sydney John Mitchell.
And you're usually referred to as John?
Yes.
And when did you first come to Dersingham?
I was born in Dersingham.
Right.
In 1916.
And do any other members of your family live here?
No. I am the last remaining
inhabitant
member of the Mitchell family, to my knowledge.
Now, I understand you, your memories go back a long way, so before we do anything else, I'm going to refer to you to one or two pictures. First of all, could you tell us something about the photograph that was in the newspaper and showed a picture of the corner shop?
Well, I remember that quite clearly. It was known as Rowley Linford's shop. His father, who was a painter and decorator, I believe built the shop with the living accommodation above. And he, I forget his Christian name, but Roland was the name of the shopkeeper. And he married a local girl, I think her name was Maisie Terrington, daughter of the butchers that operated what we now know as Mr. Lincoln's The Undertakers. The picture must have been taken before the war memorial was installed. I do not remember the signpost standing where it is. Lynn Road looks a bit vacant, but this was before it was developed, obviously. But I can see in the distance a building which would have been Emma Middleton's shop.
So there seem to be just shops and no houses.
There is a house here before you get to Middleton's, but that is the only one. There's no bungalows there at all. Mr. Wheeler's, the schoolmaster, lived next door to Linford's. And as I say, in the distance, the shop was occupied by two sisters. One's name was Emma. I forget the other one's name, but they drove a donkey and cart around the village and sold paraffin for
for heating.
The heating and lamps. Oh. And I believe their father was in business before them. And when I came back here to live, the shop was occupied by the Thaxters and was used as an off license. And it has only recently been demolished to make room for the car park.
Right.
That I remember distinctly.
Moving on to the picture of the Dun Cow, could you tell us something about that, please?
The Dun Cow, I remember that quite clearly. The landlord was Mr. Magnus. I remember him very well because he had a growth on the back of his neck that used to stick over the back of his collar. The ponies and carts I cannot identify, but as I have said, one could have well been my father, who used to occasionally call there for a pint. I also remember there was a duck pond.
Ah.
On the side here, as you're looking at it, it is a barn on the left hand side of the entrance to the pub. There was a duck pond there, and that led up to the farm, which was occupied by the Balding families.
And of course still is, isn't it?
Yes, there's a descendant of the Balding family there. That was George Balding. There were three Balding farmers in the village, I remember. Fred, who lived opposite the White Horse or thereabouts. Jim, who lived in the row opposite what is now the post office, and George, who, as I say, lived near the Dun Cow. I cannot remember the old Dun Cow being demolished, but I do know that the daughter of Mr. Magnus became the landlady after it was completed or rebuilt. The new Dun Cow, which was there before,
right, budgets. So before you left the village, the Dun Cow was as you see it. And when you came back,
exactly,
the new Dun Cow was
exactly.
So you didn't actually see it being demolished.
I would say that this certainly, the old Dun Cow was still standing in the 1930s when I left the village.
Right, thank you.
And when I returned after the war, I think it was about then that it was demolished and rebuilt.
And finally, the picture in the church magazine under Old Dursingham of the group of gentlemen, if you explain who they were.
Yes, that is a picture that I found in belongings that my late aunt Alice left me. It is a picture showing quite clearly a group of station workers, or LNER workers.
That's London Northeastern.
London Northeastern
when
Railway.
When they had railway companies, of course. And was the Dursingham station LNER then?
Oh, yes.
Right.
The poster showing Great Eastern Railway is dated 1914. It can be clearly seen. And the group consists of Mr. Chilvers, who was the then station master, who lived at the bottom of Fern Hill, and I understand lived until he was 100. It clearly shows him wearing his uniform of frocked coat and peaked hat. Also in the picture, seated on his right, was my uncle George, who was a guard on the railway, and one can see that he is a guard by his uniform. He wears a double-breasted waistcoat, and standing at the back is my uncle Arch, who was a porter, and he can be identified as a porter. He is wearing what they called a sleeve waistcoat.
They were very proud of their uniforms.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. And proud of their station.
Yes.
All stations competed with their gardens, and particularly Wootton. And, of course, Wolferton was nearly always the winner.
Of course.
Because
yes.
it had access to all sorts of facilities.
Yes.
But Dursingham, Snettisham and Heacham competed very fiercely.
And they had a very important impact in the life of the village at that time, didn't they?
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
I mean, people could get to work into King's Lynn.
Yes, yes. It was the only means. I remember also the introduction of the bus, as we know it now.
Oh, really?
Yes, that was in the 1920s. I can't tell you exactly when it happened, but it was quite an event. And up till then, of course, buses were the only means of transport. And I distinctly remember children who were, I won't say fortunate enough to go to either the girls' high school or the grammar school, they usually travelled by train.
Yes.
And one in particular, and I haven't met her since I've returned, and I'd love to meet her. And I don't know her surname, but I think it's Withers or Willers or something like that, lives down Woodside. And her Christian name was Joycey Lee. And I have a picture now of Joycey running off to catch the train. down Station Road with a hat in one hand and a satchel in the other. That would be in the 1920s, mid-19 to late 20s.
Yes, yes. Thank you. That's brought back a lot of memories. Now, going back, could you tell me something about your very earliest memories of the village, your childhood and your education and so on?
Well, some of them quite clear, some of them are getting misty. My memory takes me back to immediately after the First World War, the return of my father from the war.
And you would have been how old then?
5 or 6 years old.
Right, yes.
This would be in the early 20s.
And your father was away fighting?
My father had been away and had been a member of the Sandringham Company of the 5th Norfolks and had served with them in Gallipoli. But fortunately, he was wounded on landing and he got home. There were many that did not come back, and there's still speculation as to what happened to them.
Ah, and this is a photograph of your father.
That's my father.
Ah. When he returned?
That would have been during his service in the war. He was then a military policeman.
And he looks very young.
Well, they were quite young in those days.
Yes.
I think he was wounded, and so this is what they used to do with many of them. They would become military policemen.
Yes.
Yes, I distinctly remember that, and her father was employed on the Sandringham estate, as were many of his contemporaries. In fact, most of the village relied on employment from the estate. Something else I can recall, prisoners of war, they were German prisoners of war, and they could be identified because they had patches sewn on their, what was left of their uniforms, red patches on their backs.
Really? So that if they escaped?
So if they escaped, they would be easily recognisable. And they were employed by the local shepherd, Mr. Lincoln, who lived in Chapel Road, and tended all the stock on what was then the marshes that was between the railway line and the Wash.
And that would be the royal cattle?
The royal cattle. They were, the land for the most part, or marshes as we knew them, were owned by the local farmers. And the local farmers would graze their stock, cattle, sheep and horses, on these marshes. And Mr. Lincoln was designated the marsh shepherd and tended the flock or the animals on a contractual basis for the various farmers. And I remember distinctly him going off to the marshes in the morning in his horse and cart with the German prisoners marching behind.
Where were the prisoners actually living?
I don't exactly know where they were billeted, but I do know where Mr. Lincoln lived. And whether they were billeted in accommodation behind his house in Chapel Road, I know not.
No.
There weren't many of them. There were sort of a group of 5 or 6. I have this picture of them marching off to work in the mornings and coming home at night.
And presumably they were only billeted for a matter of what, months, before they were sent back to Germany?
Oh, I expect. It was 1918, the war finished, you see. So this, I assume, would have been, could have well been 1919, 1920.
Yes.
I was just a kid, but
old enough and big enough to get down to the bottom of the gate and peer through the gate to watch these prisoners go past.
Now, you started school, what, at the age of five?
Yes, at, what was it called now, the school? St. Nicholas Church School, I think it was known as. It is now the community centre in Dursing.
That's right, yes.
Mr. Wheeler was the then headmaster. Before him, I think Mr. Firth was the headmaster. But by the time I started school, Mr. Firth had retired. I also remember the names of one or two teachers. Mr. Alexander, I think, was the assistant headmaster. There was a teacher called Miss Catlin. And there was also a teacher who I believe has only recently died in Station Road. Miss Cook, she was by then.
Were you all in one room, different age levels?
No, no. No, we were segregated, infants, and then we'd move up into standards. Standard 1, Standard 2, and eventually you made it to the top, which was Standard 7. And you left school when you were 14. You sat for a scholarship when you were 11, and if you were brainy enough and passed the exam, then you went on, that's if your parents could afford it, to King Edward VII Grammar School, King's Lynn, with girls and boys.
Now, when you say if your parents could afford it,
yes,
what did they have to pay for? Because surely it was scholarship.
I think they had to contribute towards your journeys, your fares, in this case rail fares.
Yes.
And also you were required to wear a uniform, and that I think your parents were responsible. Because although I passed the scholarship, I was given the choice of either, if I went to, took up my scholarship and had gone to the grammar school, then my mother would not have had a new costume.
Really?
That was put to me like that by my father.
Really?
And so I wasn't too keen, and I opted for the easier way of life and carried on until I was 14.
40, right. Oh, I see. So were there, I mean, if a very, very clever child from a poor family wanted to go to the grammar school, were there any kind of village funds?
I can't truthfully say whether funds were available through the church, but there were not many that made it.
No.
For that reason, I think.
Yes, because it was partly based on wealth as well as intelligence, I expect.
Yes, income.
Right. Now, when your father returned after the war, he presumably worked, you say, for Sangenham.
Yes, he was employed on the Sandringham estate, as were many of his contemporaries.
Yes. And did you do the same as soon as you left school?
Yes. When I left school, I went to the game department. Usually you went to the gardens as a gardener or assistant gardener or in the woods. Some, if they were bright enough, went to Queen Alexandra's carving school.
Carving school?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, learnt to carve wood.
Joinery and carving.
Right.
Not carving literally, but they became very good joiners. There are at least one still in the village who served his apprenticeship at the carving school. And that was where the stud is now, and persimmon stands,
yes,
on the Anmer Road. That's behind the stud or used to be behind the stud, was the carving school, which was, I think, installed by Queen Alexandra.
So you had a kind of agricultural apprenticeship, which led on to good trade later?
No, I don't think it operated like that. You went into the carving school straight from school. I expect there was an initial test,
yes,
or an examination.
You could,
yes, yes. Or if you were on the right side of the people who mattered, you went there. For my part, I went as houseboy to the head keeper. Now, all heads of department in those days had an establishment which was paid for by the then king. And depending on the status of the head of department, so his household was numbered. For instance, the head keeper had a groom, a gardener, a maid, a washerwoman, and a houseboy.
And presumably a house.
Oh, a good house. A good house. The then estate agent, they were known as estate agents in those days, I think they're called managers now. But the then estate agent, Beck, lived in the Laycocks at Sandringham, which is still the official residence of the manager. And I believe he had a larger staff. I think he had, I know for a fact that he had two maids, a gardener, a groom, a houseboy, and then you went on to the head gardener, and obviously he didn't have a gardener because he had his gardeners all around him. I remember he had one maid, and then the stud groom, as he was known, the head of the stud, Mr. Walker. He had a very old houseboy, and I think he had only one maid.
So there was a considerable pecking order, really, wasn't there?
Oh, it was. It was a definite pecking order, and you were lucky to have employment, and the standard working week was, I think, 52 or 54 hours. You worked 6 days a week, including Saturday.
Yes.
And you had a half day on Saturday, it finished at 1 o'clock. And if you were lucky enough to have a bike, you used to pedal like mad to get home so that you could change to play football for Dursingham or cricket.
Right.
And that was life.
Yes.
That was life.
Life revolved round Sandringham, didn't it?
Oh, yes. I remember quite clearly Queen Maud, who had her residence at Appleton. It was known as Appleton House. She was, of course, one of Queen Victoria's daughters. And when Queen Victoria bought Sandringham for her son and heir, Edward VII, I think it was decided that she should be given Appleton House so that she could come down whenever she wanted from Norway.
Yes.
And she used to walk from Appleton House to Sandringham House on most days to use the post office. It had its own post office in those days to Sandringham House. Letters were not delivered. That was the function of the houseboy, to to collect the mail from Sandringham Post Office once or twice a day, and also to take the mail for posting. And of course the visits of the royal family were awaited all the year long, and Sandringham became a very busy place. They would bring the horses with them, means of transport for the most part was horse-drawn.
Yes.
And the highlight of what was known as the Christmas visit was the distribution of beef on Christmas Eve that took place every year and was held in what later became the garages. It was a glass covered building, and the beef was home produced. It was beef raised on the Sandringham estate and butchered, and then you would assemble in a queue in alphabetical order.
And that was your Christmas dinner?
For the most part, yes. And depending on your length of service and your position in the pecking order.
Yes.
So you were allocated and given the piece of beef. You took with you a nice clean tea towel or tea cloth, and when your name was called, you would plough through the mountain of clean straw that was on the floor, put your tea cloth down, and your piece of beef was banged in.
And then you could go home.
And you would acknowledge the royal family as they sat there.
Yes.
And you'd be on your way with your Christmas dinner.
Lovely. Now, did you at that time live in this house?
Did I live?
In this house.
No.
Oh, right.
I was born in Chapel Road, the row opposite the old Methodist chapel.
Yes.
Which is now redundant.
Yes.
I was born in the middle one.
That's the little cottages.
That's the cottages.
Yes.
And my grandmother and grandfather lived at the end, and I was born in the middle.
Because there weren't then that many houses along there, were there?
Well, yes, Chapel Road was fairly full. There's been the only development that has taken place is on the same side as the chapel, which was a meadow then.
Yes.
And belonged to Mr. Pratt. That has all been developed. It
yes.
is now Orchard Close, I think, and
yes.
places like that.
And then the place opposite, which belonged to the Lloyd Pratt estate.
Yes.
All up the hill.
At the back.
Yes.
Oh, at the back, yes. And that, of course, yes, that's all been developed since I left home.
So, at what point did you move up onto this beautiful view of hillside?
I left home in 1933 and went into royal service. I was a footman in the royal household until the outbreak of war, and off I went to war like so many others, and by the time I returned, which was getting on for 1950, my mother and father had died, and I went my way and earned my living in business. And when I retired from business in 1985, my aunt was still alive in Chapel Row. My late wife and I then decided to come back in this direction and set up home. And number 27 Fern Hill was on the market at the time. And my late wife fell in love with it. I wasn't so keen. I had no set plans for coming back here to live. But it just happened, and I've been here now 14, 15 years.
And it's lovely that you can look right over the village from your garden.
Oh, yes. And I will say at this juncture, if I didn't live where I live now, I don't think I should stay much longer, because I don't like what I see happening to Dursley.
Right, now that leads me on to my next question. What changes, as when you came back after all this time, you must have been rather horrified.
Well, I wouldn't say horrified, but I was certainly surprised that the overdevelopment had taken place. And I say overdevelopment. Dursingham was never what I call a pretty village, but it always was a lively village,
yes.
A very active village.
And it didn't actually have a centre as such, but what would you have said when you were a little boy was the centre of Dursingham?
That's difficult to put a finger on, because as you say, we had no village green, we had no centre. Church had a great influence in those days. It was a church school.
Yes.
What is now known as the church hall was then the Women's Institute. That was very active.
Yes.
It
seemed as if all the ladies went to that and all the children went to chapel or church Sunday school.
Chapel was very lively, particularly the Primitive Methodist. For me, living opposite, and my sister, it was three times on a Sunday, no messing about. The Chambers's were, I think it would be fair to say the Chambers's were the leading lights in the Methodist church. They lived in what is now known as, it was before Chambers's, Temperance Hotel. I think it's now the Westdean Hotel.
Yes.
On the corner. Well, that's the Chambers family lived there. They were builders.
Right.
And I think they built the chapel. And they were staunch supporters, the family. Mr. Alan Cross in the village is married to a Chambers.
Right, yes.
And the Wesleyan Chapel
in Post Office Road.
In Post Office Road was a close second. And both chapels were very well supported.
Would you say that this, you say you went to Sunday school three times on a Sunday? Was it that people were particularly God-fearing, or was it as much a social thing, do you think?
I think we were sort of more God-fearing than we are today.
Yes.
That's for certain. As a child, you had no option. You were told to go to Sunday school or go to chapel in the afternoon, and also in the evening. And
You did.
I suppose it was a way of getting rid of you on Sunday and getting some peace.
That's right. And of course children in those days did as they were told.
Yes, more than they do today.
Yes.
And then of course, as one got older, one began to choose for oneself. I think I then did a stint in the choir at the church. The vicar of those days was a Reverend Oliver, who had, I believe, had a very rough war and had become shell-shocked. And so he was an excitable character, and if we annoyed him, he got very excited.
In the choir, if you're being
Well, yes, overall, because he used to come to the church. It was a church school, and there were religious lessons twice or three times a week, and he would take those himself. They would last about a half an hour in the morning.
Yes.
Scripture lessons, I think they were called.
Yes.
And yes, Reverend Oliver used to get very excited and bounce up and down. The then organist was Mr. Rye, very aptly named, I think, because he was the son of the miller, the local miller, that operated the mill at West Newton. Teddy Rye was the organist, and the vicar was Reverend Oliver. I say the Women's Institute was very active, all sorts of functions in the evening, dances would be held, particularly throughout the winter evenings.
Now that would be, what kind of dancing would that be then?
Folk dancing? Well, today it's known as ballroom dancing.
Right, so no the proper formal in pairs.
Oh, in pairs, yes. That was before the jitterbug and jive, and and I think they call it disco, was introduced. I don't understand that form of dancing. But this was a feature of life in those days. Throughout the villages.
Yes.
Most villages.
Well, I mean, all your entertainment was made in the village because there was no television, there was no cinema.
Exactly. There was an enterprising individual named Petty Officer Warren, I think his name, an ex-naval man, who introduced gymnastics in the institute. And I don't know where the money came from. I have often thought about it. It must have cost quite a bit to equip a gymnasium.
Yes.
He did, with a fencing kit and boxing kit and parallel bars and punch balls and the lot. And we used to have a high old time about twice a week round there.
What, as teenagers or adults?
No, as school children.
As school children.
And he would take on teenagers as well. And some adults were there.
Mm.
And we were taught boxing. The basics of fencing, and picked up quite a lot there.
That must have been some of the favourite lessons of the week.
Oh yes. We used to look forward to those evenings, and also I distinctly remember the first cinema in the village being held at the Foresters' Hall. And they were silent films, and the accompaniment was by
piano,
and I think the admission was about a penny.
Which was a lot of money, of course, in those days.
A penny was a penny.
Yes.
And I believe the operators came from Hunstanton, and their name was Wells. I think there were two brothers. Now I go back to the Harold Lloyd days, and before Buster Keaton, and that was a grand night to queue.
I bet there was a good turnout for that.
It was always full.
Yes.
Always full.
Wonderful, because that was such a new thing, wasn't it?
Yes. And the other thing possibly would interest you, the local carrier most villages had a carrier. Dursingham had two. One was a member of my family, George Mitchell, and the other was Teddy Wire. And they journeyed between Dursingham and King's Lynn, and on the way through the villages of West Newton, Sandingham, West Newton and Babbingley and so on, they would call and pick up your instructions if you wanted to send a pair of boots to be made, repaired, or you wanted a parcel picking up or a pound of sausages from Lynn. They would do this for a charge of about tuppence or threepence, depending on the amount of time involved.
I mean, people with houses, I mean, did they go into Kingston to buy furniture, for instance, or did people make their own furniture, or what?
No, if they could afford it, they went to Lynn to buy, and
they would have their own carrier, presumably.
They would deliver themselves, mostly by horses and cart. Most of the transport was horse and cart. There were very few cars on the road. One of the first cars to appear in the village, I also remember quite clearly, was the one that was owned by Mr. Parker, the then grocer, who lived at the bottom of Sandingham Hill in the big shop, which I think until recently was Cranes, who made the sheds and summer houses, and is now Sandringham Windows, I think it is now. Well, that was Parker's grocer's shop.
Right, and he was the first to get a car.
He was one of the first.
Yes.
And I know that quite well, because I had the job of cleaning the car on Saturdays for a shilling. It was a Morris Cowley with a dicky seat at the back. It had to be washed and polished, and it had a brass radiator and brass handles on the doors and brass hubs, and they all had to be polished, and that would be inspected twice before he gave me his shilling.
Because presumably it was very much a status symbol again, wasn't it? Rather than something to get you into town.
Yes.
Because he'd still use the railway.
Yes, a shilling was quite a large amount. And then from there I think I became, this was before I left school, I was baker's boy at Fitz the Baker's in Chapel Road. There were three bakers in the village. It was Fitz in Chapel Road, Jarvis, where the Chinese takeaway is now.
Yes.
And Playford's, which has recently closed in Manor Road.
Yes. Yes, and there's been lots of Playfords's.
Oh yes, yes, yes. Playford's the last to close. Three butchers. Bird, which is now Scholes. Lines, or before Lines, Tansley, who built Ben Doran, the big house on the hill here.
Yes.
That was Lines and Butchers. That was opposite the Coach and Horses. It's now being developed.
Yes.
It's been partly demolished and they are developing it. And what is now the undertaker was Terrington the butcher.
Yes.
Mr. Lincoln, where Mr. Lincoln, the undertaker, operates. Pubs in abundance. I think there were six or seven.
Yes. Not suggesting that everybody were drunkards, but that was the sort of social place.
That was the sort of social centres.
Yes.
Of the village. I don't suppose that many people can remember the Alexandra that stood next to the station.
Yes.
It is still standing.
Yes.
That was kept by the Bird family, and one of the Birds became the local coal merchant. I think it is now Dunga.
Yes.
That was never a very busy pub. You would come up then to the Coach and Horses. Yes. then the feathers, then the Albert Victor, and the Dun Cow.
Did people go to their special pub, or did they do a circuit?
No, they went. They had their special pubs. For instance, it would be safe to say that the White Horse was the most popular pub for the workers.
Yes.
The Alexander was always very quiet. It would attract the odd customer coming off the train. Coach and Horses catered for that part of the village, in particular Dodge Hill. Feathers was the gentleman's pub.
Yes, nearest to Sandringham.
Yes. Albert Victor could be quite busy. And the Dun Cow also had its particular clientele. I wouldn't have called it, I don't think the Dun Cow could be classified as a working man's pub.
You say the Dun Cow was there when you went away, and when you came back it was gone. It must have been...